Action Park Media.
Welcome to Victory the Podcast. I'm Doug Ellen.
I am Kevin Connolly. Kevin Dillon is in Cannes.
He's
Cannes
in Film Fest, right? I mean, it's so weird. I feel like he's like one of my closest friends and my brother, and we work together and we hang out.
Right.
We don't golf together, but we do everything else. And all of a sudden, he's in Cannes.
He kind of mentions it in passing, but then you look on his social media and there he is, like on the red carpet, looking like James Bond with Amy May.
He's like James Bond meets Forrest Gump.
Yeah, but it's a good video of him. It looked good.
Oh, it looked phenomenal.
Who do you figure shot that? Who shoots that?
I was wondering who shot it. I was wondering who got him to post it and Michael Bublé music under it. Like it's just
It's got Amy May written all over it.
But they look great. They look great.
They look great. Yeah. So
do you think more people knew Kevin Dillon on the red carpet this time than the Entourage cast on the red carpet in Cannes in 2000?
I would imagine that absolutely. Yeah. I would imagine that absolutely. But in any event, we have a very, very, very special episode.
A very special.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we have David Nutter.
One of the biggest, most successful television directors of all time.
I mean, it's really incredible. And I'm wondering if we should discuss his accolades now or we should wait till he's here.
I don't think we need to discuss his accolades with him. Ask him about specific things, but Nutter,
He did 10 episodes of Entourage, David Nutter.
Okay, all right. I was about to jump in, okay? Connolly has done research again, which is so great, but also it's annoying because I wanted him to do research on the show from the get-go, and he refused because he's a wing-it kind of guy, which is fine. But when he does do research...
I prepare for big guests.
He tends to push me out of the way, which is fine.
But you want to borrow my sheet? You want to borrow my research sheet?
I just want to know how we're going to work together because you kind of like, I mean, I don't need to be here besides for the hat if you want to make fun of me.
Well, no. We'll talk about that. Your confidence in this hat is so overwhelming that I have no words. I don't have anything to say. I can't even knock you for it.
Well, I want to talk about a couple of things about this. So I went back to Dr. Ziering. I got a second. This was an FUE hair.
What does that mean? What is FUE? Is that an acronym for something?
It probably is, but I don't know what it is. But the FUT I did last year, and they cut into the back of your head for some reason, like, right. and then they take cares. This one, they don't cut into the back of your head.
The T in the ear, what's different?
Yeah, and the FUE is newer technology, but for some reason I did the FUT last year.
You got the cheap version first time around?
No. But I also want to say, because so many people ask me about this, because so many men actually care about it. And by the way, women too. It's a lot of women who have some hair loss that this really works incredibly well for. So anyway...
Are you wearing this hat for...
No, I'm wearing this hat because my head is not supposed to be exposed to sun. And right. because I have like, red dots that, right.
your
that
head,
you would
is
throw
head,
up.
Is it hurt? Does your head hurt?
It hurts sleeping.
Is it tender?
I've been having a hard time sleeping.
Could you put a hat on top of the
I am
the
not
hat?
Supposed to put a hat on my head.
Right. So
for
this
like
is supposed
days.
To be it. This is what you're supposed to be doing.
I'm really
this
not,
is not
supposed
for
to have
content.
Anything on my head. And okay. So we're going to talk about that. But anyway, I did this one a year ago. And then
I can't
believe
it's been a year.
And then I did this second one. And the results the first time, Dr. Ziering, they're off the charts. You even said to me at Ted Fox's Bar Mitzvah that you didn't think I needed another one. My girlfriend said it too. Now, you go into a room like this with lights like that at Dr. Ziering's, and then they put the lights on you, and you know when you don't have every bit of hair that you would want. But here's the worst thing that's happened over the last 48 hours, because Ziering is amazing. I think he's a genius. It ain't cheap, okay? It's not the cheapest thing
in
the world.
Tell me he didn't give you a deal.
He probably gave me a deal, but as I've said on this podcast before,
you've been very good to Dr.
I just wanted him happy. I don't want deals.
You don't want a guy working on your head on a deal.
No, I don't want guys cutting into my brain stem when they're not happy with the price. But anyway, two things happened. One, I posted a picture, which was nothing, just my head mostly shaved, which I've never had in my life. And I got 300 comments where people are like, dude, you look cool. Venner, the most negative motherfucker on the planet Earth, our genius musical guy. He's like, you look good. Rob Weiss.
What, like with going like the 80s, like shaved head, like high and tight?
I don't even know if it's 80s anymore. I guess it's like, I'm not really stylish, but like the fade on the side and whatever.
Right.
So I got a lot
it's
of-
It's not you though.
It doesn't feel like me, but I got a lot of comments that they like it. I got a lot of comments that I looked like Brooks Koepka, which made me feel very
oh,
nice.
Oh God.
Colin doesn't like
that.
I knew
Brooks Koepka. You know Brooks Koepka.
And who, by the way, Jenna Sims, who is his fiance, was on Entourage. She was in the Jerry Jones episode.
And if I'm not, Sophie Julia is going to their wedding, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's right.
And, well, I wonder if Sophie saw me today and thought Brooks was in the house.
She thought you were Brooks.
So anyway, but wait, let me just finish this. So two things happened.
Please finish.
A lot of people tell me it looked good like that, which, you know, if that was the case, I didn't need to spend any money. I could have shaved my head and just gone that way. If that's the case, looked like Bruce Willis, whatever. The second thing is last night, someone tweets at me that there's some experimental pill that just came out that allegedly can take a bald head, and I have not been bald, you know, I just had thinning hair, and give you like all your hair back.
Listen,
if that happened,
think in this day and age, I guess it's a research thing, but you would think, I mean, come on, with what they can do, you think they'd be able to give people hair.
Well, you would think, but if that happened after I went through all this.
By the way, you want to hear a little bit of breaking news? Sophie Julia is leaving Action Park Media.
Whoa. Now, yep. Does everyone know who Sophie is, who works
Sophie
on the Entertainer
Julia,
podcast?
Sophie Julia produces The Entertainer. But we got to tell The Entertainer Girls. We probably should mention that to The Entertainer Girls before this drops.
Why is she leaving?
But she got another job. She got a great offer. She's going to stay on as Kelly Stafford's producer. So she's going to be involved in some capacity. But, you know, listen, it's the America's the land of opportunity. She got a job offer that she wants to take, and she's still going to pop in to do Kevco.
Now, were you this positive about her? You didn't pull a, if you walk away from this, you'll never be allowed back in here.
No. We didn't know. It's all love, and it couldn't be a better parting of ways, even though it's not even really parting ways, because she's still going to be around.
Right.
And she's still a producer of our second biggest show, Doug.
Which
Victory.
Is
Kelly Stafford. Kelly Stafford.
Ramblon's coming up.
Ramblon's pulling. Yeah, we're
Ramblon's growing.
By the way, if Ramblon gets picked up, that's a hot piece of IP.
Yeah. Well, then we'll probably leave Action Park for that.
Yeah, I was going to say you go back to podcast one. All right. So this weekend I had we went to the christening. I had a christening this weekend.
Well, you didn't go to the. I mean, I guess you went to it, but your christening.
I know, but the
christening.
Yeah.
For $6,000.
The thought was that I was going to go. The christening's in New York, right? And, you know, it's where I'm from.
This is your daughter. This is
my daughter, Kennedy's christening. Zulai's family's in New Jersey. My family's in New York. It's been COVID. But I don't know what I was thinking when I booked these flights, but it was 72 hours. And the airplane flight with Kennedy.
Torture.
I mean, honestly, it was one of the worst experiences I've ever, it's the worst experience I've ever had on a plane ever in my life, ever. The way back, the way there, the way back, it was terrible, terrible, terrible.
When I had my kids, Lucas, who played Ari's son, you know, I used to tell my ex-wife, I'm like, I'm not flying with them unless it's an emergency. And I remember I was on with my son at 5-6 years old, which is obviously older than this. It was one of the flights that changed the rules. JetBlue, we were stuck on the tarmac
runway.
for eight hours.
I don't know what we would have done. I mean,
I'm telling you, people were ready to kill people, which I don't know if you saw that fight at United Airlines where an ex-NFL player, you know, but it looked like
that guy. No, but I saw the longer video.
So who started it?
I think the football player has probably got himself in some trouble.
Because they did fire the airline employee today. I did see the airline employee be real close to him talking and sucker punch him.
Right.
And then even after that guy knocked him on his ass,
he got up
and was ready to keep going.
I mean, I have a whole new, I have to apologize for many years of flying on a plane with people with babies and not being a little bit more understanding, kind of thinking to myself, like, shut this kid up. Because, you know, the ears are popping. It's tough, man. It's tough. There's nothing you can do. And everybody was really, supportive, and people were actually kind of nice. But
did you have anyone that wasn't? Because I would love to see you. I was on a plane once where I actually made communication with a guy who said he worked in distribution at Warner Brothers. So they were somehow involved with Entourage. And either Lucas or Maya, one of my kids, was crying badly at the end of the flight. And that guy turned from being my friend to really getting nasty to the point we almost had a fight.
I had a deep inner dialogue to make sure that I didn't take any of that stuff too personally. Yeah. And I was like going out for a beautiful christening, which we had a great time. The christening itself was awesome, but the travel was just,
did you take any
pardon
drugs?
My language, fucking murder. No, and not only that,
and
I'm a guy that gets on a plane and like has a couple glasses of wine to relax. I had coffee.
So no, that's
for the
a
first time.
That's
well, no, because I had to stay alert, chasing the kid around, walking the kid up and down the aisle. I had to be on the top of my game. But you got my text. I sent you an accidental text.
Yeah,
message.
Obviously you had a rough weekend because I'm just minding my own business, sitting at my computer working, trying to make Kevin Connolly a star again. And I love you, babe. So I didn't. I thought for a minute maybe you saw the new Ramblon cut.
These Ramblon cuts. I said I love you. No, you know it's funny, and it just goes to show how often you and I text. On my text thing, there's the two most common at the top of my text. It's you and Zulai.
Yeah.
So I meant to send that to Zulai, obviously, but I sent it to you.
Yeah.
And then I got a text back from you calling me a weirdo. And I thought, what?
Oh, like, you didn't even know what?
I didn't know until you wrote back weirdo. I was like, oh God. But yeah, needless to say, it was a big, I think it was Zulai and I were ready to kill each other on the plane along. It's just really, really, really stressful.
That's gonna be it for the foreseeable future.
Two hours, you know, 2.5 hours, but the 5 hour cross country thing, it's just not for me.
I don't think there's
I was telling Zulai, I love you, babe, because we had a rough outing on Sunday nights on Monday.
That was an apology, probably.
Not an apology, just like, listen, here's the thing. The christening itself was so awesome. But the travel part of it was just,
it's horrible. And travel now is even worse.
Right. It's just I was almost like hallucinating.
Do you have to be in a mask? Because I have to travel.
No,
Friday.
You don't have to have a mask anymore.
You don't have the mask. Although.
There was not one mask on the plane.
And then, by the way, COVID, again, forgetting anyone who wants to yell about being scared. It is everywhere. Every 5 seconds, someone's getting it again now.
I know. So, I'm just at the point, and I think you're there too. I just can't. I do my best. I wash my hands. I'm fucking got 42 vaccinations. Yeah. I just gotta.
I don't think that it's anything that you can do about it. The problem is you know, if you're, you know, I stressed for 2 weeks before we filmed our new scene because if one of the three of you actors,
I know.
Myself, our cinematographer, and a few other people, I was just like, we'll be out $100,000.
Well, and truthfully, anybody will tell you. I mean, I skipped my hockey game on Wednesday night. I skipped because God forbid, I blew out my knee or something.
Yeah, God forbid the team could play without you, by the way. Yeah.
Thursday night was the Kings game that I skipped. I literally quarantined for those last few days just thinking like, you know, whatever. But the other thing I wanted to say to you too, Doug, you and I talked about, and again, we just watched the cut of the scene of the new scene from Ramble On. And we had the thought of, you know, in a disaster, like if it had to be you or I that got COVID, like you almost could have done it remotely, but.
Yeah, if you had COVID, we're done.
Right, but I guess my point of what I'm saying is like that's some of the best work I've seen you do on a set, in terms of again, I don't want to get too far into Ramble On because I'm sure Doug and Ted will talk about it for hours on their podcast. But for me, like the reason why we shot that scene is, and whatever, we don't want to give anything away. People will see it, but the problem that existed in that scene that day existed in the last cut, and at the end of the day, we needed to work through that scene because it just sometimes those problems exist in stories. And I don't think that would have worked out. Like there's a world where you, me and Gary, right, could have said, all right, we'll stay on book. We'll do options and this and that, but we needed you there to knock us over the goal line. So great work.
Yeah, I really
behind the camera.
And what I'll say for everybody who's listening, you know, and I know this is victory. There's a couple of angry people who are like, if you talk about anything but Entourage, I want you dead. I mean, people are crazy.
Yeah, talking about filmmaking.
Yeah, we're talking about filmmaking, but we're also talking about this is our new show. And hopefully this is going to be our next 5 years.
Well,
and I believe, you know, I just as clearly as I can say it, this show was great a month and a half ago. This show is infinitely better now.
That was smart. I mean, like, look, you had your first cut. You got some good notes from some smart people, and then we made it better. And you know, props to Foxman for getting in there. And
So that's a good point. Because I spoke to Charlie yesterday, and he was talking to Martin. He just told him about the scene, but Charlie said about me. He goes, this guy is fucking crazy. He's like he said Francis Ford Coppola 2.0. He goes, he had a locked, colored, mixed show and something was bothering him. And he said, I'm going in and fixing it.
Right.
And I just want to say though, so everybody hears it, we'll talk about it more on a Ramble On, but you know, yes, I'm obsessive and will not stop, but that we had Ted, because I'll be honest with you, I'm tapped out for money. Not that I'm broke. Nobody needs to cry for me. I said I was going to put up a certain amount of money to make the show.
Listen, putting your own money into anything is a risk.
But Ted did not even miss a freaking beat to go, we have to continue on until this is the best.
Ted's a businessman. He's hedging his bets. And we made great strides.
But there's also businessmen that go, I'm cutting my losses. But he believes in this. And we are now we're 48 hours away from anyone who wants to see this. And I don't mean the general public. Anyone right. who wants to buy this thing is able to see right. it, and we're ready to go.
Yeah, you just got, it's time to let it fly. So we'll see. And now when we're going to take a break and we come back, we're coming back.
But we're not going to give accolades of David Nutter first. We're going to say in front of him and embarrass him.
I think we should say
call
in front
him
of
like, you know,
we're going to say in front of him. We're going to wait. We're going to bring on David Nutter, director extraordinaire, legend, after the break.
All right, welcome back. Victory, the podcast. One of our favorite directors who was very instrumental in helping us on Entourage, did a lot of episodes, but has done
10 episodes.
10 episodes. Kind of did a lot of research.
Nutter, he's mad that I do research on the guests. He wants my research sheet and he can't have it.
But David has done, you know, some of the greatest shows in television history, from Sopranos. We can talk about all of them, but Sopranos and
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
Homeland.
And also, David, you know, when we got you on Entourage, you were already known as this guy who gets every pilot that you do picked up, which is, for anyone listening out there who doesn't understand this, when you do a pilot, you want to get picked up desperately. Most of them do not.
Statistically speaking, most pilots do not go.
But statistically speaking, David Nutter's usually did go. So,
and it was his nickname was the Pilot Whisperer.
Is that true, David? Have you ever heard that?
Yeah, it's actually, I've heard that before, and I did about 16 in a row.
16 in a row?
But this is when they had like four channels.
Right.
You know, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and the WB.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So 16 pilots in a row to get picked up? I mean, that's kind of like being an undefeated boxer. Like at a certain point, it's going to come, but 16 in a row is a good run.
Yeah, but I ended up at 20 for 23.
20 for 23. Yeah.
That is
Hall
sick.
Of Fame numbers.
And by the way, just so you know, for people who like to count money, when you direct a pilot, for anyone who's hoping to get into this business, if you never work on the show again, if you directed that pilot, you get a certain amount of money every single episode that airs. So 20 television shows on the air. David could be sitting in the Bahamas collecting checks. So.
And also the good thing is, once you have success, they give you a little backhand.
There you go, Doug.
You want backhand, Kyle.
So he won, word. David, you won an Emmy for Band of Brothers.
Yes.
Right? That was, what was that shoot like?
Band of Brothers was, it was life-changing. It was a situation in which it was the first time that I think that we as a society really wanted to take World War II seriously and kind of say, let's make this history for people. Let's make this a show that people can watch and say, this is what really happened. So this, of course, was about the landing in Normandy, and of course, all throughout the going out to Hitler's Eagle's Nest and ending the war there. But it was incredible. It was huge budget, huge size, and they just in the same Private Ryan, so it was kind of a lot of that vibe to it as well. But it was life-changing. It was just so much fun and special. And I remember one of my days we were finishing shooting, and I turned to everybody and said, guys, we have a responsibility to tell this the way it happened.
Right.
And you guys have done a great job.
And what did you make, because we've spoken a lot because of Dylan and Platoon, we've spoken a lot about Captain Dale Dye, who trains actors to be soldiers.
Yeah.
What, because I did a pilot that didn't get picked up with Captain Dye. How was that working with sort of a guy that's training the actors to do one thing and you're sort of focused on the storytelling part and he's on the soldier part? Did you, because he was pretty big presence on the set, right?
Well, he was a big presence, but the most important thing I think is to really get him on your side and let him know that you're serious about this. Let him know you know what you're doing. So it's interesting. I came in and it was a situation in which I had the whole setup of the town. I said, I was saying, these guys should come in from here. These guys should come in here. I had a whole game plan. And he was like, he's serious about this as far as the military is concerned. So from then on, it was fantastic with him. He's very supportive.
Wow.
It's kind of like when I had to meet Andrew Dice Clay for you guys, which was a lot of fun.
David Nutter directed the finale of Entourage, right?
Yes.
You did? David did the finale on the hangar and going back to California. Look at Doug. He doesn't remember.
It's really sad that I don't remember. I mean, the biggest episode I remember where David was, because we were so complicated. It was the Christina Aguilera thing.
Oh,
and we had a song going. And I was like, thank God David's doing this. Because David is, which I want to talk a little bit about your process. We've talked about how I direct, which I'm much more of a words guy, and you come in and you have every moment kind of, and I don't know if you do this with all shows. I'd like to hear, because I'm assuming Entourage for you is like a fucking walk in the park compared to showing up on Game of Thrones.
Not at all.
Tell me what the difference is that, because I remember that day, your timing of the music and the this, everything was so precise and you knew exactly what needed to happen. And so how do you prepare differently for a show like Entourage, which is more of a dialogue show, even though we try to make it as visual as possible, and a show like Game of Thrones, where you're, you know, doing crazy shit with amazing amounts of extras?
Well, I think I kind of treated very much the same way each project. The thing about Entourage that really, I was frightened as hell when I got this job. I met Gary Goldman, and Gary Goldman helped kind of walk me through the whole world. He kind of was responsible for me getting in the field, because I kept saying to myself, how do they do this? It's so real. So they're in the game. They're in the middle of the whole deal. And how do they really, how do they do that? And I was just mesmerized by that ability that you guys had created. And he told me, and we talked more, and we kind of got into it. And I kind of then just kind of played with that. And so what I did was, I knew not to be too hit marks and all that kind of stuff like that. But if I could kind of hurl them in a certain area and let that kind of play out, these guys were just, of course, were magic and did it all themselves.
I think it's really funny because David says, when I got that job, I actually remember, however it came to us, whether it was Gary, I'm like, can you get him to do an episode for us? Like, it was not you getting the job, like you like you interviewed and we had approved. Like, and you know, you were, again, like, when you're on a set, there's different types of directors. David, you just feel like you're going to make your day. He knows exactly where he's at all times. And obviously, the way I look at it, I went to film school, but that's instinctual as opposed to training. So, but where does your training come from and where did all that kind of start?
Well, one thing I'll say to you is, when it comes to being on the set, every second of that day counts. So the key is to try to keep it moving. And I think the crew likes it. I sometimes will have them do more shots than normally, but I think they like the direction of things, know where things are headed. So I think that where that started was, it all started back when I wanted to be Barry Manilow.
What? In college.
Yep, I wanted to be the next Barry Manilow. I was a voice major in college, and I wanted to be the next Barry Manilow because I sang all the love songs to the girls in high school, and the quarterback had nothing on me. So I got to college, and I realized I wasn't going to be the next Barry Manilow, so I said to myself, what do I do? How can I move people and get them to feel emotion and touch them? So I took a Super 8 film class, and maybe I was going to write music for movies, but I wasn't good enough for that. But the Super 8 film class was to roll up your sleeves and go do it. So at that point, I kind of just kind of fell into that kind of attitude and kind of always knew that the organization was everything.
Where did you go to school?
I went to the University of Miami, and it was kind of a film school in which it was a learn-by-doing school in which I had two very hip professors, and it was kind of a situation where they had gotten all the CP16 cameras from the news channels because they all went to video. So we had a lot of equipment, a lot of stuff, so we would kind of go fall on your ass, make a mistake, and then do it again. And that was fun.
Doug, you didn't know that Barry Manilow was like a major influence on...
No, I had no idea.
If you watch Game of Thrones, the final documentary...
Barry Manilow was in it?
No.
Game of Thrones, Could It Be Magic?
Which song?
They did it.
Could It Be Magic?
They did a tribute to Nutter.
Yeah.
When they played the Barry Manilow song, I looked over, Zulay's crying. Zulay is crying. It's super emotional.
I believe... I mean, the beginning of Could It Be Magic, I could be wrong. Is that Rachmaninoff?
Yeah, sure, Chopin.
It is,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Chopin? So, yeah. I mean, weirdly enough, just aside.
I love Barry Manilow.
Story. So the first record I ever bought, there was a song called Magic. Yeah. And my father took me to the record store to get the song. And if you know the song. And we went and I said, get me the Magic song. And we came home and it was the Barry Manilow song, not the song I wanted.
Could It Be Magic.
I also, which, you know, some young people might be listening to this, I love Barry Manilow and saw Barry Manilow in concerts. One of my first concerts in Camp Pontiac. But so did you play piano? Did you?
Yeah, I played piano a little bit for myself and sang and wrote songs and stuff.
And not to go off on Barry Manilow thing.
I just think it's awesome.
But the Clive Davis doc, it was kind of like Barry Manilow when I was growing up was this beyond genius guy, which he still is.
Oh, yeah.
But he didn't write most of the stuff, yeah. and really kind of Clive Davis, right? Like kind of like...
Well, he came in and did that as well, but it was a situation one night, I remember sitting in my bed and lying in my head and the radio comes on and Barry Manilow's version of I Write the Songs comes on.
That make the whole world sing.
I was totally gone.
I love Barry. I mean, he was, what was it in Foul Play, I think.
Oh, yeah.
It was a great song. Great movie, Chevy Chase,
ready
Goldie Hawn.
Ready to take a chance again.
Yeah. Yep. So,
Game of Thrones, Homeland, The Sopranos. That checks pretty much every box for me. What was Sopranos like?
What I found out about Sopranos was this. Everyone was so devoted to David Chase's vision, and there was a sense of fear on the set a little bit because of that and understanding that. But, you know, every time I sat down with them and talked to these guys, they were all very great to the point, gave me real matter-of-fact answers about things. And my thing was just trying to keep up. And also, I wanted to realize that even James Gandolfini wants to be directed.
Right.
You know, and a lot of directors can't, you know, kind of don't go up to the stars and say, well, blah, 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 something. But as long as I did my homework and talked about stuff, that was good. And the other good thing about the Sopranos situation was James Gandolfini was in a coma. So, and he's very, very method, or was, of course, very method. And he was in a coma. So in the coma scenes, he stayed up all night and slept all day in the bed. So at times I had to stop him from snoring. I had to knock him, move him a little bit from snoring. And then the character he plays was a really good guy selling a sunroof, sun panels for solar energy in a guy from New Jersey in Orange County. And he was playing this real normal guy. So I directed the normal Tony Soprano.
That's right.
The killer guy.
When he had the alter ego. That was, yes. Oh, interesting.
Yeah, David Chase said that was his number one episode.
Any fear on the Entourage set that was there any of that?
Yeah, he was terrified of you.
My only fear was to do a great job.
Yeah, well, you did, for sure.
Because you guys were so, everything you did was great. I think all the stuff that Mark Mylod and
Julian Farina.
Julian guys started with Logan Donald Joe. Was just brilliant.
So how does a guy like, I'm not even being funny. I got to work with Imperioli on, he did a pilot with me, and one of the great actors I've ever worked with. But Gandolfini and Edie Falco, who...
probably, you could argue, two of the best to ever do it as a husband and wife couple on TV.
I can't think of a better.
They're definitely up there.
So when you're walking on that set for the first time, which you started, did you start in season one? No.
This is like season three, four.
So you're coming onto this show, which already is like this iconic thing. How is that tough to walk up to actually? I know on our set, because our set was so relaxed and so casual, and everybody's kind of just regular Joes. Is there any fear walking up to Gandolfini and Edie Falco, or did they just welcome you in? And
well, no, I think they're very guarded, which is important. So the main thing is, I think, it's just to kind of talk to them and not bullshit with them, and just talk normal stuff and let them know that I'll, you know, if there's something that whatever, and not pick at little things and so forth, because that's a new thing, because that's what they're so wonderful at. So, but it was also a situation where I wanted them to know that I was there for them.
Right.
Because there's so much going on. It's like, you can't really pinpoint what that's all about. But it was interesting. One thing I did was at the end of the production meeting, and everyone's very silent and quiet during the production meeting, I stopped and I said, David, I just want to let you know you're a very fortunate man. This crew is behind you 1,000%, and I've never been on a crew that was so dedicated to really portray your vision of a show. And there was silence.
He just doesn't give you anything back.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That's so strange.
It's just the way he is, apparently, right? I mean, yeah. It's like,
he just seems, and again, he's a genius, but he seems angry. But so,
as opposed to you?
It was interesting. He'd always called me the maestro. I don't know why, but
well, there you go.
That's nice. Yeah.
That's good. I have a question. And this is, I would ask this question of you too, Doug, right? So, David, you do so many shows, okay? So when you're going into a show that's existing, how many episodes do you have to watch of the show? I mean, obviously, if you're going on to Homeland or popping onto one of these shows, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to sit and watch the previous whatever episodes. You're not going to watch every episode of the show. So how do you familiarize with yourself with a show that's been running for a minute so you can actually speak intelligently to the characters and sort of what's happening, right? Is there like a cheat sheet kind of vibe?
No cheat sheet. It's interesting when you say that. My son took a gap year, and he was working for me as an assistant on Shameless. And so I had him watch 6 seasons of Shameless in like 3 weeks. And for an 18-year-old kid, that's a pretty rough show to watch.
right.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on there. but to me, it's a situation which I got to watch enough shows to really get me a sense of feeling who the characters are.
Right.
And that's vital. So when I did my first ER, I was like, how the fuck do I do that?
Right.
So that was really important to keep that going.
And is it true that you did a 21 Jump Street?
Oh, yeah, that was my first job.
How about that? He directed 11 episodes of 21 Jump Street.
What's interesting about that is I did a little bit of a movie in Miami called Ceasefire with Don Johnson. Then they then went to that movie in Miami. Then they hired him to become Sonny Crockett. So then I came to Los Angeles and couldn't get arrested directing traffic. And the movie got a lot of great reviews and so forth. And couldn't get arrested directing traffic. So I used to play golf when I was in junior high school. So I'm a director in Los Angeles in Hollywood. I got to direct, right? I can't do anything else. So I had to spend a lot of time on the golf course. So basically I went out one day on a Sunday with two guys and somebody happened to join us on the golf course. And it was Patrick Hasberg. And Patrick Hasberg had just created Hardcastle McCormick, and he also just created this new show called 21 Jump Street. So we started talking, and I was kind of I was bitter at this point, didn't think anyone was going to come up and so forth. He started talking to me, and I found out that he was a ski instructor to Michael Eisner, Steve Cannell, and Michael Ovitz in Aspen. And Stephen Cannell took him under his wing because his son died, and he was a good writer. And so he came out to Los Angeles and became the Hardcastle McCormick. But we played 18 holes of golf. He asked me all these questions, and we sat and had a beer. And he said, "Well, you know, let's you're gonna hear from me tomorrow." So he went to call Steve Beers, his production guy, and said, "Steven, I want you to hire Dave Nutter to direct an episode in the spring." He goes, "Well, okay, I'll look at his movie. We'll talk about it." He goes, "No, hire him."
Hmm.
Well, Patrick Hasberg also was the first guy to hire Brad Pitt. Was the first guy to hire Johnny Depp. Was the first guy to hire early George Clooney in a motorcycle gang. I shot with him. I directed him an episode of that. But
I play golf 2 days a week, and nobody does a fucking thing for me out there.
I know. But I'm
Jesus
telling you,
Christ. I write
every golf game off, too.
I'm playing the wrong golf course.
I still write the golf games off.
But it is, fucking like bullshit, I said, man. When you see how David operates.
He must have said something.
He said something.
I'm saying the wrong shit on the golf course. That's what I'm doing.
Off the topic, since we're talking 35 fucking years ago, yeah. But Johnny Depp, who I think it was pretty famous story that he just became a giant movie star while that show was happening and just said, "Get me off of this show." But A, what was he like to work with then? And B, are you watching this trial at all? Which is just insane.
Well, I have to tell you a couple points of that. Interesting. But Johnny Depp, I worked with him up in Vancouver, of course, in the show. I fortunately did an episode where Amnesty International was involved, and Peter Deluise's character falls in love with a girl from Nicaragua who's on the run from the immigration department. So Peter marries her to try to keep her in the country, and it doesn't work out. So what happens is that she gets sent back away. We had Sting gave us music for that episode.
Wow.
And Peter Gabriel did a PSA at the end of the episode.
For 21 Jump Street.
Yeah. So we won an Image Award for that. And then when the next episode came about, when they went to Miami, they followed some kid to Miami on an overnight bus to Miami for spring break and get sucked down there, and the episode happens. And after the episode, they're at the beach, and Johnny Depp says, "Let's go down and try to find her." So then that episode took place in Nicaragua, and I directed that, and basically you two gave us some music, and Bono did a PSA at the end.
Jesus.
Which is fantastic.
And Johnny Depp was dying to get off of the show.
And this was the time where Johnny was dying to get off the show. This is the time where he and Renata were really together, very, very tight, and he was getting tired of the series, and he did a lot of things with hair in his face. And it was a situation which
a lot of things with his hair in his face.
Bruce didn't like that. He didn't have to do that. So then one night came up. It was a very important evening because it was a really great scene about loss and this girl dying and a really pro Amnesty International storyline. And I just talked to him about it. 5 minutes later, he came out with a band on, hair back, and did the scene beautifully. But Johnny Depp's a great guy. He's always been a great guy. I actually directed a pilot in Austin, Texas, called Jack and Bobby, and Amber Heard had a small role in the show.
I remember Jack and Bobby. I loved it.
Yeah, she had a very small role in the pilot.
How was she?
And she was a very small role in the pilot, but I thought she was fascinating. I thought she was great. And I said, "Come out to L.A. and I'll get you an agent. So she came out to Los Angeles. I hooked up with an agent at William Morris Endeavor, of course, Endeavor in the day. And then she hooked her up with Joan Hyler, the big manager who handles all the big stars, and Charlize Theron. And Amber just...
So you're essentially responsible for this whole trial.
Yes,
that American.
It's my fault. Exactly.
So when you're working with Johnny Depp, who's at that point 21, 22 years old, are you like, "This guy's a movie star"? I mean, I've got someone. Did you know? Did you feel that or what?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I felt that just immediately.
Did you feel that with Connolly at all? Or no?
Absolutely.
Let me ask you a question, though. Do you think, and I know that it became a thing for Clooney as well. Clooney finished out his contract. Do you blame a guy or gal who is now getting these other opportunities and wants to explore them? Do they, you know, I mean, and believe me, it's probably more than just Johnny that wants him off the show at that point. It's probably his agents. It's probably a bunch of people. So
I do.
What do you think the Clooney route, finish out your contract that you signed?
I think when you agree to a contract, you finish it out. We know on a show how many people are being employed
that's
by that
true.
Show
fair
and
enough.
who may not have another job after that. I mean, I haven't worked since Entourage, so right. If one of you bailed out on me, I would have been unemployed then. So I think, yeah, I think you finish out your contract, and if you're going to be a movie star, you'll be a movie star 3 years later. Now, that being said, we all know Tom Selleck was unable to do Raiders of the Lost Ark because he was stuck on Magnum PI, and maybe he would, I mean, he still has a good career, but yeah, maybe he would have been.
Right. No, listen, there's lots of examples of that. I mean, you know, Hugh Jackman wasn't the original Wolverine. I mean, there's endless. Here's one thing I wanted to ask about. So for people listening, with episodic TV directing, a lot of times they're kind of put together. So it'll be David Nutter is going to do episode 1 and 2. Mark Mylod is going to do episodes 3 and 4. And then David Nutter is going to do 5 and 6. So you kind of alternate. And that's sort of you're prepping while the other one's shooting. And that's kind of how you run through a season, yeah. Right? Nowadays, there are directors, and I think you might be here, which is why I wanted to ask you this. Now, they're taking these full seasons and having one director do it. I mean, if you look at Big Little Lies, Jean-Marc Vallée, I mean, rest in peace, did Big Little Lies, right? He did all those episodes.
Right.
That is a tall order that you're talking about 10 hours of television. You're talking about a 10 hour movie. Is that something that you're doing currently or you're considering doing? How do you feel about that as opposed to 2 episodes here, an episode here, as opposed to doing all of them?
Well, I think that I finally got a script that I've been wanting to make all my life. I said to the writer, I said, you know, this screenplay is something I've loved all my life, even before I read it. I just was in love with the promise of that script. Something hit me. And I'm a big schmaltzy guy, and I love romantic stuff, and a smart repartee, as Doug is so well-versed at.
Thanks.
But it was a situation which I had to do it, so I stayed and did 6 episodes. And we shot 10-hour days.
What was
did
this?
It responsibly, and go ahead.
What is that? What show are you talking about?
Oh, sorry. Time Traveler's Wife.
Oh, okay.
Thanks. On HBO. To the show, to the pitch.
On HBO now.
It's on HBO right now. They just did the second episode Sunday night.
Oh, I'm excited.
So you did all of them?
I had directed them.
Jesus Christ, that's a lot.
So wait, so it's a 6-episode first season, or that's the end of it?
6-episode first season.
Okay, all right. So I'm going to watch that tonight. Time Traveler's Wife on HBO.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely worth watching, for sure.
Yeah.
It's something that'll get you hooked, and every episode gets better. But to go back real quickly about the contract, one secret that I had is that I had a secret of Vancouver. When I did Smallville in Vancouver, you know, Tom was up there getting started and so forth. He lives in Vancouver. That was his thing. That show lasted 10 years. Then Steve Renell went up there and did Arrow. Met Tom and so forth. They became friends and so forth. He was up there for 8 years. Between Smallville and Arrow was Supernatural. Those guys are buddies. They all kind of lived together, the whole kind of world. They were there for 15 years. Jeez. And Grant Gustin been up there for 8 years for Flash. So take the shows to Vancouver and say, you'll keep your actors. Because what happens when they're in Los Angeles, the managers are with them all day and saying, they're scared that the actors are going to leave them. So they're saying, oh, these producers suck. They don't even care about you. I know it's good for you, da da da. So I think it's good to keep
them. Lock them away.
That's what I did.
But also, I'm not suggesting that you have to do 15 years on a TV show. I'm just saying if you sign your initial contract, you fill it out. Yeah. And once it's done, if you want to leave, you leave. The most interesting question about your career to me is every television episodic directors, it's a tough gig. You're coming into somebody else's show every week. There is a bunch of egos and you're trying to fill in with a new family. And really, most people, why they do that is because they want to get to become a pilot director. Right. Because a pilot director is as close to a film director as you're going to get. Yeah. You have just a giant, enormous influence on that show. You, who is one of the most successful pilot directors in the history of the business.
Pilot Whisperer.
Yeah. Why is it that you just love directing? Why do you love going on to doing so many episodic TVs when it's clearly not about the money? What about that process is it for you?
Well, for me, it was a situation in which the first pilot that I directed, I was going to stay on and produce it and direct, but there was some contractual thing happened and I couldn't do it. So I said, well, brokenhearted, I can't stay on the series, but I'll go back to X-Files. And I directed four great episodes of X-Files, including Ty Bruckman.
It's crazy.
And then I did another pilot that didn't go. It went for a couple episodes, but at that point, I just decided not to stay on pilots and just do the pilot and leave. One year, I did the Roswell pilot. I loved the show. I loved working with Jason Kadams. And we talked about doing a certain situation, how we would do this creatively together. It didn't really work out that well. So James Cameron called and got me. They said I could do Dark Angel. So I went and did that pilot.
Jesus.
So I kind of stayed over. But what I've done is I do the pilots in the first half of the season. Then the second half of the season, I go to a show I wanted to hopefully be on.
Right.
Entourage was the case. West Wing was the case. Band of Brothers, The Pacific.
But you really just, you ER. Love being on a set and directing.
Yeah, but I don't work, I never work that much as I've worked now in these six episodes.
That's my point. Like the idea of doing it's a 6-hour movie. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's just mind-boggling amount of work.
I'm excited to see it now. And just explain, so anyone listening can understand, when you're in making a movie, the director, besides obviously the producer studio, always they're the heads, but doing a pilot is or doing all six episodes is probably the next best thing. So how much creative freedom did you have on that show? How much did you work with the writer? And how much is the studio on your back when you've done so much in your career?
Well, the good thing with HBO was that they liked the script so much, but they were worried about the script, how things would be handled, how this would be directed, how this would be dealt with. Stephen Moffat is just so brilliant. He's from England, of course, and what happened is the fact that this is all during COVID, so they couldn't come over to the States very often, or hardly at all. But what was important to me, that I wanted to make sure that I got them as much stuff as possible and scenes as possible, and they saw stuff and saw what we were doing in production, pre-production, and he seemed to be quite good about everything. Very, very smart and very giving, and I made sure he went over everything with him. The key was to make sure that there's a communication. It has to be a communication. You can't, like, say one thing and do the other or something like that, because to me, the script is the Bible. And as a director, I don't want to bring my influence into the show. I want the script to be seen and you don't notice me. I don't want to be noticed that I'm directing. I don't want to be thought about or talked about.
Right.
I want to be basically the story does that. So that's a very important thing for me to do that. And on this show is basically, Stephen was very nervous because there's lots of comedy beats in it as well. And there's one big important scene in episode four that there's lots of doors and ins and outs and positions and so forth. And he kept worrying about that sequence. And so I basically put together a diagram for him and I showed him how I would do it. Then I basically shot it with the actors and did a rehearsal with it and cut it together. And once he saw the scene, he was like, I'm good.
That's awesome.
Right.
And what was really nice is that this was not a situation where we showed him a cut of the show and he'd be like, pickpointing this and that and this and that. He was very smart about the cuts we made and very together about all that stuff. And it was just a real true pleasure.
That's awesome. Yeah. I can't wait to watch it tonight. And obviously Game of Thrones is, you know, one of people's favorite shows of all time.
It's awesome. But real quick, because I want to talk a good chunk of Game of Thrones. But before we get into Game of Thrones, what any Homeland anecdotes? Because we need a good minute for Game of Thrones. But what was Homeland like? Manny Patinkin, serious,
Alex
very
Ganza
serious.
Alex Ganza was on Entourage for a minute.
Serious actor.
The creator of
Serious actor. What? And Claire Danes is awesome. That Homeland's one of my favorite shows. It's up there on the list with, you know, Game of Thrones and The Wire and whatnot. So what was Homeland like? At what point did you join that show?
I came there when they were shooting in North Carolina before they went off to Berlin and South Africa and all that kind of stuff. But the most the interesting thing for me was that Claire was very Claire was great. You know, making material people when I met him in prep and so forth. They kind of pushed past along. I was a good guy and all that stuff. And Leslie Linklater was running the show. She was fantastic, of course, to work with. And but Manny Patinkin.
Yeah.
He's got heard the stories about, right?
Yeah.
So, I have Manny Patinkin albums. I'm a Manny Patinkin fanatic. I went to see Sunday in the Park with George, the 25th year anniversary, and they performed it in a libretto.
Right.
I basically said, Manny Patinkin, I love you.
Right.
So, when he saw that I was really into his Broadway career and all that stuff,
right,
smooth talking.
He knew that you knew what he was and
why,
what he was
capable of. Is Mandy allegedly difficult?
No, he's serious.
A long time ago, it was like Chicago Hope days. That was a thing. But
well, didn't he walk off? Didn't he quit Criminal Minds at 25 million?
Yeah, he did.
He just walked off. He said, "I'm done with this show." He's making like a gazillion dollars a year. He just walked off the show. Yeah, it's crazy.
He's about passion,
right? It's all about passion. That's interesting. All right, Game of Thrones. This is the big. Yeah. One. So, how do you do that?
probably one of the most expensive shows in the history of TV.
Right.
How much prep? Like Entourage, you're coming on probably 2 weeks prep, maybe less.
Oh yeah, yeah.
How much prep is there for Game of Thrones episode?
Well, a lot of times it used to be a situation where I did four of the seasons, and it was a situation which we go to basically different locations because the show was shooting in different locations. So you shoot your block in Ireland, or shoot your block in Spain.
Wow.
And then go to Iceland, shoot your block, and go to Africa and shoot your block, or go to Croatia and shoot your block. So it's all kind of pieced together. The last season, the eight episodes, I directed three of the eight. That season, they said, okay, David, we're going to start rolling on October 9th. You're going to be the director until December 22nd, every day.
Wow.
So I created a movie. So I had to do a six-hour little movie for that. But what was really great is that my episodes in season eight were really the episodes that kind of got to know the characters more.
Story episodes.
Yeah, the episodes we introduce characters in one. The second episode, they're all waiting for the big battle. Fourth episode, big battle's over, and now what's the next thing that's going to happen?
Right.
And the departures and so forth and that. And so,
what excites you more, and maybe both equally? Big battle sequence, do you go, oh, I just can't wait to get into
what
this?
What a scope, look at the size.
Or, I want to sit with these
dragons.
Two people at a table and learn stuff that nobody's...
Listen to Vince and E chop, hack up Doug's script, or watch dragons get slayed.
Because I honestly, if you told me, if you gave me $100 million and said, go direct a Game of Thrones episode,
go,
I wouldn't even
no
know
idea.
Where to
I
call
I'm
David
with you.
Nutter. I need help.
Well, I think it's interesting. When I did The Pacific, which is an episode series, they did $27 million an episode.
Jesus.
They spent on. Because what happened was that Band of Brothers has been the highest selling DVD in the world every Christmas. Because your kids give it to their parents. All that kind of stuff. So there's always a little check in the mail for me for that, which
Love
is
it.
Always nice. But with The Pacific, I directed an episode, and another episode was coming up, and it's right around the Writers Guild strike. And so a lot of things are kind of feeling out what's going to happen. And so Peter Roth wanted me to direct Fringe, the pilot for Fringe, and come back to the States, knew that. And Fringe was not a strong version of X-Files. And I said, Peter, I had a meeting with this writer and read the teaser of his pilot, and I think this one could really be special. And that was The Mentalist. And
Jesus.
And so he let me go with that. So what
You're a loser,
was,
Doug.
So they want me to do, they want me to do this Iwo Jima episode. So I said, here's what I can do. I can spend, let me shoot the Iwo Jima part, the action part, the scene. And then, of course, Jeremy Padezza directed all the other sequences and him coming home and so forth, the character John Basselman, played by John Seda. And so that was fun. That was 12 days of go and do it. Because I was basically shooting Iwo Jima, and there was no beach. We had basically, HBO would kind of come in and brought in $1 million worth of black sand and so forth, came in and dug out this whole deal. And I created Iwo Jima with that. That was probably the most exciting battle sequence.
How many cameras are you shooting on a big battle sequence like that?
Sometimes four or five, and sometimes you have stationary cameras as well. And then probably the most daunting action sequence I ever shot was the one in Game of Thrones where it was episode 509, and they're having the big festivities where Danny is with the new. Group she's with, which I've forgotten their name, and the dragon there becomes a riot in the big stadium, and then the dragon comes in and flies in and saves her.
Oh yeah, so, yeah, God,
that was a lot of stuff. That was a situation, doing that deal with that. I sit down with each actor and kind of get them to talk through it and be interested in what we're going to do, and then also do it's all like offense, defense, football kind of thing. It's like, these guys, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. And just get everybody kind of involved in it that way.
So a little more complicated than Piven and Christina Aguilera having a little chat.
And what is it? What are you actually looking at when the dragon, what's the eye line for the dragon? Because we know it's not really the dragon there. It's a giant green ball.
A green ball, yeah.
And are you...
How big is the green ball?
You should, let me put it this way. You should hear me on a set. I'll go...
I would love to see that, because honestly, I've never done anything even remotely close to that, so I can't even imagine. Everything I've ever done is so grounded and realistic. I can't imagine being like, all right, Collie, the dragon's coming at you. So are you like... Because, I mean, you were
animated. And here comes the dragon!
It has to be.
Yeah.
You have to keep people in it.
Yeah,
you have to basically sometimes sound like the biggest fool on the set, and sometimes not.
Right,
but you have to get people to be all reacting to the same thing, And that was very important.
Remember, you guys, David directed.
Here's a little
story. Gary Goldman chiming in, please.
What's he yelling
Gary
about?
Remember, David directed the most popular Game of Thrones ever with the most popular scene, the Red Wedding.
The Red Wedding.
You directed the Red Wedding scene?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, not that I hate to like get your directing is great in everything, but that obviously is one of the most memorable moments.
Well, people refer to it like it's like the Red Wedding, right? Yeah. Like when I did something that's like, yeah, we think Red Wedding, like it's become like almost like a reference point for scenes. Yeah.
And I obviously like to talk one thing. My belief is the best script is going to be the best episode, but when you get a script and you tell me, is there any time some people, which Game of Thrones is one of my favorite shows of all time, some people had problems with season 8.
Yes.
Now, it's definitely a little different. I think the book was over. Have you come onto a show that you love and gotten a script that you don't love, forgetting Game of Thrones? But are you like, oh, I didn't get the best episode. What can I do to make this better? Or do you work with the writer? And how do you do that?
Well, I did a show once, and it was an episode of Lost in Space. And this is about a time where I had some back surgery, and I was not working for a while. And I came back, and I got this Lost in Space, and I worked out the deal with the director who ended up being fired off the show. So I came in, and they gave me the last episode of the season. So it's like, okay, here's the deal. And they started talking about the character of Will Robinson. And this wonderful actor, who, Gary, you have to give me his name quickly because I have to say it out loud because he's so wonderful. This young kid who played the Will Robinson character. Now, when I was younger, Billy Mummy was my hero, the original Lost in Space series. He was the man. And I grew up without a dad, and this kid was the man. He always had the courage to do this and that kind of stuff. And the thing with the young kid was this actor, who Gary's going to give his name, he was very emotionally driven. So he was in a situation where he could cry on a dime. He'd even come into a scene with me and say, oh, I'll cry here and cry here and all kinds of stuff. And I basically, the first thing, this is the episode in which his character steps up and saves the family. So basically, I just started off with this. I said, first of all, we're not going to do any of that shit. I believe in talking to young people like you're talking to an adult. Sometimes you talk to adults like you're talking to a young person. And with young people, I say, always talk to them like an adult. And so I said, you're not going to do that anymore. You're Will Robinson, and you're the hero. You're the tough guy. We're not going to cry here, and it's going to be a situation where there's a big scene at the very end where the robot's kind of has gone haywire, and he doesn't know if he recognizes him or not. And don't you remember me? I'm Will Robinson. I said, no. You're going to be Batman. You're going to walk up to him and say, I'm Will Robinson. And this kid was so great. He was so incredible that he had that other part of him, that other side of him, that he could explore that stuff. And you got the name, Gary?
Max Jenkins.
Such an amazing actor. He ended up getting 6 foot tall too very quickly. But what happened was
Connie's upset.
What happened was the fact that this guy, he did this amazingly, and he's kept in touch with me ever since. He really felt that I was the one director that kind of pulled him out of that child acting.
Right.
And that was very important. And that to me was what I looked for.
That's awesome. Yeah. But if the script is not working, and you're coming onto a show that's established, that's had great, great episodes, but you don't think you have.
Like, if
a
you didn't like your Homeland episode, can you go, I'll rather wait till a better one comes down the pipe?
I will say this Homeland episode was not the best they've had because they were giving those, of course, to the producers and stuff. So that was a tough one to live through.
That's what I'm asking,
David. You have to make the most of it.
You've got enough money that you can do whatever the hell you want.
Right.
Do you just love the action of being on a set? Because it's a really hard thing to direct an episode of television. It's a really hard job. Some might say you're underpaid to do that.
Right.
So what makes you go in and go, I'm going. I'm doing this pilot. I'm doing this episode. Do you just love being on the set that much and working with all these different things?
It's interesting. We did a thing on a DGA talk and answer with maybe 4 or 5 directors, and everyone was on remote access. We started talking and so forth, and people were saying how I'm this and I'm that, and I'm this and I'm that. And I leaned back to them, and I kind of said, guys, and I came up to what happens, and one of the questions was, David, how do you get up for something? How do you, if it's not work, if you don't have the juices or something, whatever. And this is right about a time when My wife had just passed away from pancreatic cancer. And but a year earlier, 2 years earlier, and I hadn't told anybody this, I came down with Parkinson's disease. And so the thing of it was, is I realized that when I'm on the set, when I'm doing this, I have no pain in my joints. And nothing hurts. I feel like $100 million. I feel like a young man. I'm doing what I love to do. And I think that this project that I just did is a love letter to my wife, only time traveler's wife.
That's really amazing.
It really is. It's also personal to me. It's not a job. I don't know how to do that.
Right.
And I got to be honest with you, David, I feel that in you. And
yeah, I mean, it's you can feel it. It's visceral. You
know, and right? I know, because Connelly and I, we're very similar. And a lot of times it's the anxiety of it that stops us potentially from doing more things than we probably should have done. But exactly what you said, when we were just on the set the other day, which, you know, I've been on a set 10 days over the last 7 years.
Right.
And I do. I feel at home. Yeah. And it makes me go, this is what I would love to be doing every day. And the grind to get there, though, is what's challenging. And you've obviously overcome it. And it's amazing, and you can feel it. And I just want to give you a little story that you don't know. But when we were looking for a director for the Entourage pilot, we're just like everybody passed on it. And I get this call that they're friends with. They know David Frankel well at HBO. Right. And they think they can get him to do it. But I got to call him. Now, I want to check up on him. I call David Schwimmer, who did Band of Brothers. And I say, how's David Frankel? He says, he's a fucking genius. You would be so lucky to get him. And by the way, David Frankel is a genius, and
he
I was lucky
very
to
much
get
so.
Him. But as David Frankel walks into the office to talk to me about the Entourage pilot, my phone rings and it's David Schwimmer. And I go, oh, look. And I hand it to David Frankel. I go, it's David Schwimmer. And I see the look on David Frankel's face, like, why am I giving him this phone?
Why? Well, that's a terrible thing to do to somebody.
And then I see them sort of like, hey, and I realize they don't know who they are. David Schwimmer was talking about you. Because you did Band of Brothers with David Schwimmer.
Yeah, of course,
so he thought,
David Nutter, David Nutter, David Frankel. Right,
so now funny. David Frankel was great, and they got it. It would happen. But
Schwimmer was recommending Nutter?
100%.
That's hilarious.
100%. And going, oh my God, he's amazing. And I remember him telling me, he's on the set, he's fucking this, and making everything happen. So he loved you very much on Band of Brothers.
A question for you. Last question, David. So before we started rolling, we were talking a little bit about, you know, like you're talking about time travel's wife, and we're talking about responses. And I always thought about this with Game of Thrones. Personally, I loved the ending of Game of Thrones. I think that they were in an impossible situation at the height of social media. You were just not going to satisfy the wolf pack that is social media. The heat was coming no matter what. I mean, I don't know how they could have wanted it to end. Whatever, you could have a problem. But I think a big part of that was just kind of social media, just backlash in general. And you mentioned a little bit about response that comes from social media. How does that change the game, the social media response? And is that play into anything? Or how much does that...
There's no way it plays into David Nutter's life.
Not David Nutter.
No, it actually hasn't really come into play recently. But I have to say, in season 8 of Game of Thrones, there were so many people that were so invested in the show.
Right.
Personally, emotionally, that they all had their own endings.
Right.
You know, there were people I know that had, like, Dany Targaryen named the children after Dany. You know, and then she became a bad person. Oh,
right.
My God, how do I call her that? But but it's a situation in which when everyone wants their ending, you can't satisfy everyone. There's no way to do that.
Right.
But recently on Time Traveler's Wife, there's a mention of the word grooming in a novel where the hero, Theo James Henry, is meeting with the younger version of the character Claire, which is, of course, Rose Leslie from Game of Thrones. And people started talking about the grooming part and so forth and thought this was kind of like those are weak and lazy reviewers.
Yeah.
Who basically saw something from the book and kind of jumped on that.
Right.
And I think that's a misnomer. And also it's an attack on creativity.
Yeah.
In many respects. Well, they're not critiquing what we're doing. They're critiquing what they read.
Well, there's clearly, listen, the PC culture, which is not necessarily new, even though everyone thinks it just came
out. Well, it's just heightened
today,
with the internet, right?
But it's very heightened, and every review seems to lean on looking at things like that, which is it's a shame because obviously when the book was written, that word didn't mean what it means today to whoever. And that's a shame. And I don't believe that most people watch stuff like that. I think that is critics that are in their,
of course,
in their magazines, and they're supposed to find their fucking stupid PC
their
problems,
hot take,
but
or they follow a big critic and kind of go his way, whatever that is.
Because I'm sure when you read the book and you're reading the scripts, it never entered your mind that that's what they're talking about, because it wasn't what they were talking about. Sure. You know, I watched, I haven't seen Valley Girl in 30 years. I watched the movie two nights ago, and like, there's a scene where the guy is chasing a girl around a car, and she's like, stop, stop. And, and you know, in 1980, people thought it was kind of cute. And now you're watching it going like, what's this guy's endgame? Is he going to like catch her and rape her? Like,
right.
But it's just times have changed and people look at things very differently. But I just think
the social media aspect of it is just jumps all over it. And I don't think that there was an ending that would have made people happy with Game of Thrones.
No way.
Well, no way.
What I will say, and I don't want to, because what I was trying to say earlier, to me, the script, the best director in the world cannot make a bad script great.
No.
So that's why I was asking what they can do. My personal opinion, the book ran out in Game of Thrones. To me, season 8, it wasn't that I was expecting some ending. It just had a different pace.
People were just too connected to it.
No, I disagree.
And David and Dan came in and kind of started to create the ending.
Yeah, I just disagree. It had a different pace and a different tone to it, and it wasn't that I was expecting any type of ending. It became a little slower.
I loved
it. But that's great. And that's why
I'm a story guy, though. It's the difference between you and I.
Yeah, yeah. I'm an action guy.
Yeah.
I mean, come on. So, but I
love the green ball. How big is the green ball, the dragon?
It depends. It can be a basketball.
It can be like a tennis ball, yeah. Right?
Like, no, not exactly. It's not going to be a tennis. It's like a beach ball.
I think Jurassic Park.
It can be tennis ball too. Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. It depends how close it is. But there was a moment in when Steven goes and touches the dragon, pets it, I guess. And so they have a green-shaped head or something that she was touching, sit on top of. And
it's just so wild. Now, when you're directing that episode, are you still around when all the CGI and effects comes in? Are you still there, or you're off on Homeland while that's going?
No, I'm there to give my cut. But the visual effects take so long, you can't really hang out for all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it's really a wild process. I should have asked you if I could follow you around Game of Thrones. Mark Mylod also did Game of Thrones.
Oh, episodes. He's a great director. Yeah. I actually... he was the first guy I recommended to them to hire.
Yeah.
And I was glad they took my opinion. Wow. Took my voice a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah, that's great. Well, David, I mean, you've...
Very informative episode.
Yeah, you've had such an amazing career. Me and Connolly both feel like losers because we've basically done nothing.
Doug, where were you when he was working on The Mentalist? I guess that's the question.
I was...
And sad to say, that was one in which they were trying to give us David Schwimmer, and we said, we think Simon Baker's the guy.
Is that right?
Yeah. But David wouldn't have done it anyway, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know, but that's interesting. I mean, but your career is amazing, and
Entourage was a huge part of that, and I think that working with you guys made me a much better director, and it was a great experience to do it. And one of the things that people always ask about the success of the show, and I would say the success of the show is this: these are a band of brothers. These guys love each other no matter what, and are behind each other and will care for each other no matter what. And you don't get that. That's special. We all dream of that. And that's what made the show special.
Yeah. Well, I love that you take that from it, because that was my intention from the start. And I spoke to you a couple of years ago when your wife passed. And again, I'm so sorry about that. And your passion, and I think for anyone listening out there, that's what you need to work like David does, who does not need to work ever again in his life. And it's inspiring to me. It really is. And I thank you. I'm excited to watch Time Traveler's Wife.
Yeah, it's on Time Traveler's Wife
on HBO.
Sunday night to 9 o'clock, and then anytime you want to watch it.
Yeah, it's all on now. Yeah. So I'm going to start that tonight. Victory, the podcast, exists. David went out and... it was his episode that was the Grand Canyon, and shot the hell out of one of the most iconic moments of our show. And at the same day, I don't even know if you know this, David, and don't tell me you directed that episode too, but Tony Soprano that night was at the Grand Canyon, Sunday night on HBO. They both were at the Grand Canyon, which is so fucking bizarre. But anyway, I'd love to hear about your first episode of Entourage and then that Grand Canyon kind of episode moment.
Well, as into my first episode of Entourage, I was shooting it right in the beginning of the year, January. But prior to that, I was in Vail, Colorado, skiing with my family, and I went down the hill and tripped and broke 6 ribs.
Jeez.
On my left side. So I basically had my pain medicine with me in my pocket, and I said, off we go. So I drank that Hofer's episode totally whacked.
I don't even remember.
It was perfect because it was about the what the name's calves.
Dylan's fake calves.
Yeah, the calves was fantastic.
That was the episode where we were on the beach with Jamie Presley, the bonfire, and the big party. Right.
Yes, exactly. And that was the one which I remember how we're going to talk to each other. I remember I sat at my little monitors behind the actors, kind of looking up, and I'd be doing whatever, and doing directing from there. It was going to raise or something. It was crazy.
I mean, that's what I'm saying about you, David. Like, you have six cracked ribs. It's like an episode of television that you don't need to be doing, and you just want to keep working.
I had to do it. It was so such a pleasure, such a treat.
That's awesome.
That was a good episode. But and tell us the Grand Canyon part of what are your memories of that besides you and Dylan and Gary in the helicopter flying back on a scary flight?
That was a very scary flight. No, I think to me it was really a situation in which, you know, Johnny Jama was a dreamer, and we're all dreamers. And he basically, this was his chance to really shine. And he was so fearful. The first scene is when he goes in, as he has went for breakfast, he goes, oh, everything will be just fine. And all of a sudden, a pigeon flies in through the window.
We talked about that. We don't know what that was based on.
Whatever it was fantastic. But it gets to the very end of the episode, and he's going off to do a Thelma and Louise, and what happens, he wakes up, and how he shot it was the fact that we wanted to basically set up the car and set him up in the car. As he starts to get up, we would kind of discover, as he discovers, your guy's attitude. So, of course, Aiden came out and started talking about, are you going to come be my brother to make breakfast? Right. You guys add in. And then the agent comes in and basically says, it's a huge hit. And as that all happened, Johnny would kind of stand up and we can start to realize where he's at. We start to realize where he's at. And at the end, you know, it was a beautiful sunset shot, and he basically right there, and he looked out, and it was so beautifully done.
Rob Sweeney
did a tremendous job shooting it. He was actually on a crane out over the Grand Canyon.
Oh my God!
The crane would have dropped, he would have fallen to his death. Oh, and we got this great shot of him on the victory, and it was just like, it was so massive and so epic and so profound. And I think it had a lot to do with the show again. A dream's coming true for these guys.
It really was.
And them
awesome.
All supporting him.
And we were talking about it with Dylan last week. You know, you set that car up so close to the edge.
Gary did it all. Gary put it in there. He got it in there right close. We were very, very close.
We were saying there's also one of the surprises as we're explaining to people listening, like what a skeleton crew is. So you guys sort of left us all behind and you went out and shot that. And when you guys came back with that footage, I just remember it was like, what the fuck, man? How did these guys, A, where are they? B, how did they get, I figured it was a crane, you know, it just big, wide shots. And it just was, I just remember the excitement on Doug and Lev when you guys just come back. They don't know what's going on. And all of a sudden, here you guys come back with this magical footage that's iconic and still to this day plays on scoreboards. When professional sports teams win,
they get a check for that, don't you?
Yeah, exactly, for sure.
You see, Nutter knows what's up. He's like, yeah, I guess they should get.
That's great.
Yeah, they play it on scoreboards after big wins in sports. They have, you know, Dylan dropping to his knees and screaming victory.
Yeah, so it happens all the time. I know that the Lightning do it. Or, no, the Rays.
No, the Rays do it.
The Rays do it all the time.
That's great.
Good all right, stuff. Well, David, it was again. You're awesome, and I hope you're feeling good. And you know, it's great to see you.
Thank you so much. Good to see you guys.
Hopefully,
too.
we'll get you in to do a Ramble On episode.
Yes, sounds good to me.
I want to show you a cut of that.
Sounds great.
Thanks for coming in, and everybody will be back next week with Victory the Podcast.
Thank you.